Now, my previous section said they wanted the lights like this. Is this how you like it? Or do you want even more darkness or even more light?
Less light.
This one good?
What's the other one?
Is that too dark for anyone?
I like it. It's all right.
All right. It's up to you. Tell me if it's... want me to change it, though. I'm pretty sure that we finished slide two, right? Yes, we did. Okay, so we're on slide three, and now things will speed up a little bit in terms of getting through the slides is concerned. In slide three, we are looking at a pictorial representation of an ecosystem, as we defined it last time. So it doesn't matter what the ecosystem is, but the picture itself represents an ecosystem. And the point with the arrows is that for any given ecosystem, energy flows through it, whereas materials get recycled within it. So energy comes in as sunlight, as you see, originally. It gets changed along the way, but eventually energy leaves as well. So there's a throughput of energy. But all of the various materials made up of atoms in various combinations, not perfectly, but more or less stay in the ecosystem and just get recycled. So the atoms that you're made out of right now are not the atoms that you were made out of last year. You know, that might have been part of a rock or something else. You're always being rebuilt out of the materials. Of course, I said it's not perfect because, yes, there are some materials that leave an ecosystem or come into it, but pretty much they stay in the ecosystem and get recycled. The energy, on the other hand, as in slide four, goes through, as I said, and it comes in as sunlight, the yellow arrow. That sunlight allows for photosynthetic organisms to make organic molecules that the rest of the world, including us, eat. And so energy gets transformed and transferred within the ecosystem. Transformed means it's changed from one form of energy to another. It doesn't stay as radiant energy, which sunlight is an example of. It can be transformed into chemical energy, for instance, as it does in the bonds of the organic molecules that organisms are made out of and that get eaten. Transferring energy refers to moving it from one body to another. And body there just means object, not necessarily a living body, although living bodies are bodies. So the materials are staying put, but energy comes in, and eventually, after being transformed and transferred, the energy leaves the ecosystem as heat, which is what the red arrow is all about. But we'll have much, much more to say about energy as a major concept in Unit 3. So we're kind of bouncing all over the place in this introductory chapter. Let's go on to slide 5, though, and look at this bird example. This is just one of countless examples of an important concept in biology that's often summarized with the simple phrase, form fits function, which you've probably heard. Form refers to anatomy, really, how an organism is built. Its morphology is another word for its form. And form fits function means that organisms are built the way they are simply because that allows them to work well. It allows them to function in whatever their situation is. And what mechanism causes this to happen gradually from generation to generation? How is it that form fits function so closely eventually? Well, mutations cause the genetic variation that's required for the process I'm talking about to work. But mutation is doesn't make anything better necessarily. It just simply allows for new variations of DNA.
Adaptation
is the result. Natural selection, exactly. So these random changes are going to just happen randomly. But if they happen to work better, if they happen to function better, then natural selection will favor them, meaning that they'll have a higher likelihood of being passed on. And so the better and better adapted populations get, the more that their morphology really is. That's why it looks like they're designed. Natural selection is not a design process. It's just simply changing things randomly and seeing what works and saving the things that do work. So in this bird example specifically, well, first of all, birds are often thought of by humans as these real delicate organisms. But birds fly, at least most species of birds fly, and flight is a really demanding process. You have to withstand a hell of a lot of forces. So you have to be a strong machine in order to fly. Birds might seem delicate to us, but they're really not. They have to have strong bodies, and namely a strong skeleton. And you can see the inside of a bird wing bone here in this figure. The stronger the skeleton is, the more it can withstand the forces required that it's going to have to withstand for flight. Well, the more material you use, the stronger the skeleton will be. But what's the problem with that? Heavier it's also going to be, and so you can be plenty strong, but you're never going to get off the ground, which is also a problem, right? If you need to fly. So there's a trade-off here between strength of skeleton and lightness of skeleton. Birds, by natural selection and caused by random mutation, have kind of solved this problem by having what are called pneumatized bones. Pneumo means air, like air-powered tools or pneumatic tools. Pneumatized bones means they're hollow. They have these spaces in them. As a matter of fact, as part of birds breathing, the air goes through their bones. Quite different from us. But anyway, they're pneumatized to make them lighter, right? But why is it that they can still be strong enough? Well, if you think about this from a design perspective, which natural selection isn't, but it's instructive to think about trying to design something that will fly or that is both strong and light. If you just think about building a cylinder, which this bone basically is, if I tell you you need to make a cylinder that's strong, but you have to use exactly this amount of material, you cannot go over, then you could, as your cylinder, just make it a solid rod, right? That by obeying the limit of the amount of stuff you're allowed to use would have a maximum diameter. It wouldn't be a very big diameter, though, because you would be wasting all your material by having it be solid. Or it ends up being a waste, as I'll say. The problem with a rod is that since it has a small diameter, it becomes easy to bend, right? Doesn't take much force to bend it. If, on the other hand, you say, I'm going to use the same amount of material, but instead of making a rod, I'm going to make a tube hollow, then that same amount of stuff can make a much wider cylinder, right? Much bigger diameter. If you're going to bend either one of these, you have this line is the axis that it has to begin with, and if you're going to bend it right here to say this angle, that bending on one side is going to involve compression, right, in the rod here, this is going to go down, this is going to go up. You're going to have to compress it right there. You see what I'm saying there? And this other side is going to stretch. Well, the amount of stretch, I mean, the amount of compression on a rod, because of its small diameter, is much less than the amount of compression corresponding on a bigger diameter cylinder, which is why a cylinder is harder to bend. Same thing for the how much you have to stretch it. Does that make sense? This is exactly why you see modern bicycles have very big tubes instead of small tubes with thick walls like they used to. The materials have gotten better also and lighter, but you see large tubes on bicycles nowadays and they're strong as hell because it's really hard to bend a large diameter cylinder. So you make very strong bones that are strong enough to stand up to flight without making them too heavy to disallow for flight. And that doesn't happen overnight. That happens gradually through the generations by natural selection until you have a close fit between form and function. All right, switch gears again on slide 6 and talk a little bit about cells. We've already said cells are truly important as a absolute criterion, required criterion for being an organism, right? So every organism is made up of a cell or more that has ever existed. That cell, whatever it is, has an official boundary between itself and the rest of the universe. The outer edge of the cell, in other words, is formed by a membrane called the plasma membrane. And so that's really what makes the cell a little test tube, as I was referring to it before, inside of which the specific set of chemical reactions that we call life can happen in isolation from the surroundings. So that's why a cell is so vital to being alive. It's a compartment. But if you think about cells just as an entity, there is a dichotomy of cell types. A dichotomy is, di means two, is a two-part way of thinking about things. The dichotomy of cell types means that there are two major categories of cells. Any given cell is either prokaryotic, which is one of the two types, or eukaryotic. Can you even see in this amount of light? Can you see the board at all?
Yeah.
Okay. Even in the back? Okay. Notice the similarity of these words. They share this karyo root. The true root is karyon, which means, originally it means kernel or core of something. So in terms of cells, the karyo refers to what the kernel is of a cell, if it has one, is the nucleus, the cell nucleus. Pro means before. And so prokaryotic literally means before the nucleus. In other words, before, this is describes cells that are like those before there was such a thing as the nucleus. It came on the scene evolutionarily much later. So most of the history of life on Earth consisted of only prokaryotic cells that didn't have a nucleus. EU, pronounced U, is a prefix that means true or good. And so eukaryotic literally means having a true nucleus. And you can see two cells here in this picture. The bigger one, by far, in this picture, is the eukaryotic cell. This one up here is the prokaryotic cell, as labeled. A nucleus, if it is there, which is this big purple thing in the eukaryotic cell, a cell nucleus is an example of an organelle that we talked about before when we were examining the hierarchy of biological organization, right? It's one of the levels, the organelle level. So not only is a nucleus an organelle, but more specifically, it is an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. And since I've just used that phrase, I want you to alert you to the fact that there are two very similar sounding phrases that mean different things. Membrane bounded and membrane bound do not mean the same thing. Bounded is the past tense of bound, which means to form a boundary with. Right? It's the edge of something. For instance, the United States is partially bounded by the Pacific Ocean. Bound, on the other hand, is the past tense of bind, which means to tie or connect to. So later on, I'll be using the phrase membrane bound to refer to certain proteins. Membrane bound proteins are not surrounded by their own membrane. They are part of a membrane. They're tied to it. You see what I'm saying there? Whereas an organelle, if it's membrane bounded, means it's wrapped inside its own membrane. Well, the etymology of these two words, prokaryotic and eukaryotic, is based on the presence or the absence of a nucleus. That's the only reason those words exist. But that's not the only difference between the cells. It is true that no prokaryotic cell has a nucleus, which is a membrane-bounded organelle. But a prokaryotic cell doesn't have any other membrane-bounded organelles either. There are other kinds of membrane-bounded organelles, and we'll study them later. Things like mitochondria and chloroplasts, endoplasmic reticulum and whatnot. You find those in eukaryotic cells only. A prokaryotic cell has only one membrane, which is its plasma membrane. Now, the plasma membrane is in both types of cells, but that's the only membrane a prokaryotic cell has. And so hopefully it makes sense to you that a prokaryotic cell is therefore only one compartment. Anything that is inside the prokaryotic cell, even though it's made of different things, all of that stuff collectively is called the cytoplasm. Cyte means cell, and plasm means stuff. So literally cell stuff. A eukaryotic cell, since it has some number of membrane-bounded organelles, not only the nucleus, but other ones as well, is more than one compartment. I mean, it has the interior of the cell, everything inside the plasma membrane, but that interior of the cell is then subdivided by the other membranes. Just like rooms in a house are subcompartments within the overall house. You don't have that in prokaryotic cells, just one cytoplasm. Well, a eukaryotic cell also has cytoplasm, but it doesn't include everything inside the eukaryotic cell. For a eukaryotic cell, the cytoplasm is everything that's inside the cell but outside of the membrane-bounded organelles that it has. And so the brown stuff here is cytoplasm, the background color. But that's different from the stuff that's inside the nucleus, for instance, which gets its own name, nucleoplasm. And it's not just that it's a different name. The nucleoplasm is different stuff compared to the cytoplasm, has a different chemical makeup, which is why eukaryotic cells are able to do things that prokaryotic cells can't. Because they have this subcompartmentalization, they can have different things going on in different compartments. All right, that's enough for six. Let's go to seven. Now, the last time I told you something important that cell theory says, what is that? So what I said cell theory says is that cells come only from pre-existing cells, which, yeah, usually involves a splitting. Here we actually see the opposite of splitting. You know, new cells come from pre-existing cells by splitting, but the cell that you started out with, which I said is the zygote that defines your identity, is actually the result of the fusion of two cells. Two gametes, a sperm and an egg from your parents, combine into one, which is kind of an unusual thing. But then after you're formally created by being a zygote as a one cell, then splitting makes you two cells, each of which splits, you have four, and that's how you grow into a multicellular organism. Now to eight. You probably knew that this is DNA, even if I had no label on it. It's a famous molecule. And we're going to spend half of the term talking one way or another about DNA. So this is not going to be the only thing I'll say about it, but just want to give you a couple things that are important about DNA right now. First of all, it is an example of a nucleic acid, which is one of four categories of biological macromolecules. Pretty soon we're going to get into a chapter that surveys all four of those kinds of biological macromolecules. Nucleic acids is one of them, though, and DNA is a type of nucleic acid. RNA is another type. But DNA is, macromolecules in general, all four of the types, are called macromolecules, macro meaning big, because they, even though they're tiny from our point of view, they are much larger than most run-of-the-mill molecules. And DNA is not only an enormous molecule, but it's really two enormous molecules in one, which are then held together loosely. You see one half of it, or one strand of DNA on the right edge here, a tiny, tiny piece, because these A's, T's, C's, and G's are the building blocks of the strand, and there are millions just within one strand in each of your cells. And then there's another strand with the same number that matches up here that would look like a ladder if you had both of them, but then that ladder is twisted into a double helix. Helix is just a corkscrew shape. So when you twist a ladder, you're making two helices, each one formed by half the, what is the vertical part of a ladder? The style? Whatever. Two strands, though. And that double-strandedness has a lot of important properties that we'll get into later that allows for DNA to have some important functions. Now, what did I already tell you, and probably I wouldn't have had to tell you this, but what did I already say DNA is responsible for? Traits. Yes, for indirectly giving you your traits. And I keep stressing indirect because your traits aren't directly because of your DNA. the traits that you or any other organism has are directly the result of the particular kinds of proteins that the organism is able to make. Proteins, by the way, is another one of those four major biological molecules, biological macromolecules. And proteins do almost all of the important functions of the cell, and they are involved in all important processes. They give you directly your traits. But proteins are also very complex molecules that don't just pop into existence. They have to be built. The cell has to know how to assemble them, has to know which building blocks to use and in what order and how many to use to make the final protein. So it needs a set of instructions. Well, DNA is not actually the set of instructions. DNA is a set of instructions for how to build the other kind of nucleic acid, which is RNA, which is now a set of instructions for how to build the protein. So it's a two-step process, which we'll revisit later. Those processes are called transcription and translation to build a protein. But only one of those, the first, is DNA involved in, which is transcription. So DNA has two major functions, and transcription is one of those. The transcription function is all about telling the cell eventually how to build the proteins that it needs, but that also gives it its traits, gives the organism its traits. Yeah?
Can you repeat that one more time, sir?
DNA's job, one of its two jobs, I haven't given the other one yet, is transcription, which is the process of telling the cell how to build an RNA, which then gets translated, that DNA is not involved in the translation process, gets translated, and that's how you build the protein. The proteins then give the organism its traits directly. Now, does anyone know the other job of DNA? This transcription, what I'm talking about, this is when your genes get used, minute to minute, day to day. You have a light, you know, the entire chromosome, well, you have multiple chromosomes, but each chromosome is like a library shelf full of books. Each book is a gene. Each gene is a manual, a how-to manual for how to build an RNA molecule. So what you do really in transcription is without taking that book out of the library, you just write down that information. Now you have a manual in the form of RNA for how to build a protein. So that's one important job. That's your day-to-day during your life, what DNA is doing. What is the other important function of DNA, though? The other is replication, which refers to making an exact copy of itself. And that's the entire strand, which is many genes big. We'll get into the particulars of how it works later, but the replication job of DNA is important for building new cells. As we've been talking about, when a cell creates new cells, it does so by splitting into two. So you've created two cells, but all cells require DNA, because without DNA, the cell won't be able to build any proteins. Can't live. So if you think about splitting a cell which has DNA into two cells, it would not do the job to just give one of those two cells half of the library, some of the books, and the other cell, the other books. Neither one of them would have a complete set of the manuals it needs, and therefore neither one would live. So the only way you're going to successfully split into two cells, by which I mean create two viable cells, cells that can live, is to first completely duplicate exactly your whole library of DNA. That's what replication is. And then right after that's done, you can give each cell a complete set. so it can live. And then within the lifetime of those cells, they will use transcription indirectly to make proteins and live their life. All right, now to nine. Now it's time to talk about feedback mechanisms. I knew there was a more manageable eraser. Before we get directly into the feedback mechanisms, though, let me tell you that feedback, understanding feedback or understanding the why feedback exists requires understanding the concept of homeostasis. A word that literally means staying the same, even though it's really not true. Stasis is the noun form of static. The adjective static means not changing, opposite of dynamic, which means changing. And it's not true that cells ever stay the same. They're always changing in one way or another. But homeostasis refers to maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. So organisms or individual cells, if it's a unicellular organism, do things to keep conditions within tolerable limits, even though they are changing. They're not changing much, or they die. And maintaining homeostasis involves feedback mechanisms, of which you see there are two major categories, negative feedback and positive feedback. Importantly, only one of these, negative feedback, can ever lead to or maintain homeostasis. Positive feedback is not homeostatic. It will not lead to or maintain homeostasis. Now, before we get deeper into the two kinds of feedback, let me say that any feedback involves a variable, which, of course, is something that can vary. Some condition, something that you can measure, basically, is a variable. And a familiar, easy-to-understand example is temperature, but there's all kinds. pH would be another one. At any given moment, there is a value of that variable, right? The temperature is whatever it is, for instance, using temperature as the variable. But there's also a desired value, what the cell wants the temperature to be, which we call the set point. And this is exactly analogous to the set point that you program into a thermostat for a room. Right, you tell the thermostat, this is what I want the room to be at. But at any given moment, the room is almost certainly not exactly at that set point, right? The real variable's value changes moment to moment. You want it to be at the set point, but it's going to be at some value. And if it's not exactly at set point, the variable that is, then there is what we call an error, which simply means the difference between the value of the set point and the value of the variable at the moment. Notice that an error, if it exists, we would call it a zero error if you just happen to be right at set point, but that's rarely exact. Notice, though, that if there is a non-zero error, if there is some difference, then it can be in either direction. So for the temperature example, it can be too warm above set point or too cool below set point. Well, I don't want you to be tempted into thinking that negative feedback would take care of one of those scenarios and positive feedback the other. That's not right. Negative feedback will take care of both of those types of errors, either too high or too low. And it's the only kind of feedback that can do that. If you think about the word negative linguistically, it is the adjective of negate. Right? Negative means having to do with negating. To negate means to get rid of. So negative feedback is named for the fact that it operates in such a way that the error, the size of the error, gets reduced. The error gets negated, in other words. Which is another way of saying that it operates in such a way that the variable will be changed so that it's closer to the set point, which can happen in either direction. Also, for the room example, you set the set point for a thermostat, and if it's too hot, it will kick on the air conditioner to bring the temperature back down to the set point. But if it gets too cold, it will kick on the heater so that it brings it back up to the set point. In both cases, it's minimizing the error and trying to negate it. That's why negative feedback is the only feedback mechanism that can lead to homeostasis. Positive feedback does just the opposite. Whatever the error is to begin with, positive feedback is going to make it an even bigger error. So it moves the variable farther and farther away from set point. Now, by far, most feedback mechanisms in living things are negative feedback mechanisms because they are homeostatic. There are positive feedback mechanisms, though. Sometimes they are simply pathological. They'll kill you. For instance, if someone cuts my arm off, I'm going to start gushing blood, right? That's going to drastically drop my blood pressure. So my body's going to respond not realizing that I've had my arm hacked off. It's going to try to get the blood pressure back up by making my heart work harder, which is going to squirt more blood out my arm, making it even lower blood pressure, and so it just gets worse and worse, and I'll die. There are, though, some actually normal feedback, positive feedback mechanisms, but since they aren't homeostatic, they're always temporary. They'll last to do whatever job they do, and then they have to be replaced by negative feedback mechanisms to get things back to normal. And almost every textbook uses the same classic example as though it's the only example. There are many positive feedback mechanisms, but the one that's used by textbooks most often is parturition or childbirth. When it comes time for the fetus to become a baby, emerge from the mother, in most cases the head is downward, pushing on the cervix, the narrow part of the uterus, and that head is therefore stretching the cervix, and the nervous system senses that stretch, sends information to the brain saying that it's happening, and the brain responds by releasing oxytocin, a hormone, like other hormones, it travels through the bloodstream throughout the body, but most of the body ignores it. The uterus, when it receives the oxytocin, responds by contracting, especially at the top part where the feet are, squeezing that fetus farther down, pushing the head farther into the cervix, which stretches it even more, sending an even stronger impulse to the brain, causing it to release even more oxytocin, which causes the uterus to contract even more. And if things go well, the kid pops out. That's a temporary thing, though. And then if the mother survives, which is usually the case nowadays, negative feedback mechanisms will bring her back to normal. In this schematic on slide 9, each schematic represents its own kind of feedback. The A's, B's, C's, these are chemicals. Doesn't matter what they are, but the arrows represent chemical reactions. So you have end-to-end arrangement of chemical reaction. That's called a biochemical pathway. Anyway, A gets turned into B, which then gets turned into C, and so on. Eventually you form D, the final product. Doesn't matter what D is, but what you can imagine, hopefully, is that if you keep making D, eventually you'll get to the point where you have too much D. You don't need it anymore. And so D, whatever it is, feeds back into an earlier part of the process and turns off production of even more D. So it solves the problem. It reduces the error of having too much D. On the other hand, on the W to Z pathway, Z is ramping up production of even more Z. So that's making the error even worse, right? That's positive feedback. Yeah.
Hypothetically, just for my brain to picture it, if you were to use the thermostat temperature example,
yeah.
What would positive feedback look like with that?
Well, this is what it would look like chemically. Mm-hmm. If Z is some sort of chemical that can interfere with this enzyme 5 and make it an even better enzyme, an enzyme's job is to convert something into something else, in this case X into Y. If it does an even better job of that, it's going to speed up production of more Y, which then becomes Z.
Mm-hmm. So for a situation like that, would it just not be possible at all?
No, it's possible. It's just it has to be temporary. Because this building of the error, it might be that you want a building up of error. For instance, like some plants will explode their seeds out. And that happens because of building something up until it actually gets to a certain point, and then negative feedback will take over.
So would it be correct to say, like, if your desired temperature was 80 and you were at 70, would positive feedback look like you're making it hotter, but then it...
No, that's what I said I don't want you to think of. Okay. If it's too cold or too hot... Either one, negative feedback takes care of. Mm-hmm. Because if it's too low, the effect of the negative feedback will be to raise it back up to set point.
So then would it be getting colder, and that would be positive feedback?
If it's too cold already, positive feedback would make it even colder.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And if it's too hot, it would make it even hotter. Increases the error. Okay, now to 10. This is another hierarchy. We talked about the hierarchy of biological organization, but this one is a hierarchy for classifying organisms. Classifying means putting them into groups. And we've been doing this literally for millennia, but we've been doing it different ways throughout those millennia. In any case, these groupings that I'm talking about are called taxa. That's the plural. One group would be called taxon. So that's a real general word. It means a group of any size. Each of these headers up here, species is a taxon at one level, genus is a taxon at another level, family is a taxon, and so on. But it's a hierarchy because a class, if we're just starting in the middle, a class is a group that includes groups within it called orders, each of which includes families. So that's the hierarchy of it. Now, you've probably heard of kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, and species. You might not have heard of domains. I'm not sure, actually, whether you have or not. Have you ever been taught this? Okay. Well, they didn't all exist. We've changed classification over the years, and not just over millennia. In my lifetime, it's changed pretty drastically. When I was in grade school is when I first was taught anything about classification, and kingdoms were the biggest groups, the biggest taxa. At the time, there were 5 kingdoms. Originally, before me, there were 2 kingdoms. When we first started grouping things together, all they cared about was plants or animals. You're either a plant or an animal. They didn't bother to think about any other kind of organism. Then there were eventually five kingdoms during my lifetime, and they were the biggest taxa. Now there's many more than five kingdoms, and they're not even the biggest groups anymore. They're not. There still are kingdoms, but there are even bigger groups that we've created that contain the kingdoms. And those groups are called domains. And they are the most inclusive groups, meaning they include the greatest number of things. So as you go from domain to kingdom, it becomes more exclusive. Only some of the things that are in the domain are in this kingdom. And only some of the things that are in that kingdom are in that this phylum and so on. Until you finally get to genus and species. Speaking of domains, slide 11 shows us that there are three domains that we recognize. And these are mutually exclusive groups, so you can't be a member of more than one. Any given organism that has ever existed, not just the ones alive now, is a member of exactly one of these three domains, which, as you can see, are called bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. Now, we just got through talking about the dichotomy of cell types, right? So in terms of categories of cells, there's two types, prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. By the way, these adjectives correspond to nouns as well. Any given organism, no matter how many cells it has, is made up of only one type of cell or the other. So prokaryotic organisms usually are just one cell. But we call them we call the individuals prokaryotes, with an E after the T. Whereas a eukaryotic organism can be single-celled or multicellular, but we call the individual a eukaryote. We are eukaryotes, we humans. But notice that there's two cell types. There are three domains. One of the domains is called eukarya. And not just by coincidence. The domain eukarya is named for the fact that it contains all eukaryotic organisms that have ever existed. And that's all it contains. So all the eukaryotes are in eukarya and nothing else. No prokaryotes. But the prokaryotes of the world don't have just one domain. There is no domain prokarya. So all the non-eukaryotes, which is another way of saying the prokaryotes, are in either the domain bacteria or the domain archaea. And it's pretty easy to guess what kind of organisms are in the domain bacteria. That includes all of the bacteria that have ever existed, which is by far most of the organisms that have ever existed. Archaeans, the members of archaea, might look similar, if you look at them under a microscope, to bacteria. But there are some very important differences that makes us put them in their own domain. And in fact, even though they outwardly look similar to bacteria, as you'll study more in Bio 182 if you take it, archaea and eukarya are more similar to each other than either one is to bacteria. So that makes good it makes good phylogenetic sense to have all three of these domains. But that's more of a 182 topic. All right, now to 12. These cartoons are two cilia, which is the plural of cilium, which means hair, even though these really aren't hairs. True hair is made only by mammals, like us. But things that look like hairs, we call cilia. It's a little projection from a cell, from the surface of a cell. Looks like hair. But we have a cilium from one organism and from another organism, and these are drastically different organisms. The pink one's from a paramecium, which is a eukaryote, but it's not very, very closely related to humans, which are also eukaryotes. It's a single-celled eukaryote. The other one is, the blue one, is a cilium from a cell in the trachea of a human. So drastically different organisms, but they have almost identical molecular structures in their cilia. And so this is just one tiny bit of many bits of evidence that point to the fact that all organisms are related. They all go back to that common ancestor. If, you know, which natural selection has allowed for certain, it allows for diversification, speciation. So there definitely are different types of organisms, but natural selection's been happening all along. And if something happened by random mutation that was really successful early on in life's history, then many descendants are going to share that thing, like the structure of a cilia, So it's an ancient, this is something that evolved a long time ago and is still working, so it hasn't really changed. Well, 13 is about natural selection as well. And I've already kind of told you about natural selection, which is the mechanism for evolutionary adaptation. This one gives you some pictures to look at, though, to explain it even more. We have here a population of insects. Doesn't matter that they're insects, just an example. And like any natural population, the individuals are not genetically identical, there's variation. And therefore, there are different traits from individual to individual. And those traits could be just about anything. We don't, the only trait we care about in this, just to make it simple, is the color. But there are some individuals that are darker, some that are medium, and some that are lighter, as you see. They live wherever it is, on a surface that's pretty dark. That's what the black background represents. And they're just, you know, trying to survive being these insects. But you also have a predator here, this bird, that eats these insects. And to be a good predator means to be an efficient feeder. Right, you eat for energy and for raw materials. But it takes energy to forage for food. To look for the insects, in other words. So, you're going to be successful as a predator, meaning survive better, if you can save as much of that energy that you take in as possible. So you can devote that energy to growing and reproducing. This is why a predator, this bird is not choosing which one of these insects to eat. It's not saying, I refuse to eat until the right color bug comes along. It's simply going to snatch the first one that it can see and not waste energy looking for other ones. Well, the ones that are going to be easiest to see, of course, are the ones that have the highest contrast with the background. In this case, the lightest ones. So it's DNA indirectly that gave that lightness to those, in this case, unlucky individuals of the population, right? and being eaten kills the bug and therefore reduces the chance of passing that DNA to zero. That means the next generation will have a greater frequency or a greater percentage of individuals that are darker. And it gets more and more like that. That's what natural selection is, right? It results in, eventually, a population that's much darker than it was originally, which means that population is much better fit to the dark surroundings. Thing is, the environment never stays, well, it's always changing slightly, and sometimes it can change drastically all of a sudden. Whether it's an earthquake or whatever does the job, there can be a sudden change, and that mixes things up immediately and causes natural selection to select for something else. And this is much like a real thing that we noticed 100 years ago or so. I think it was moths, but it was some insect. It was just the opposite condition, though. They naturally lived on the bark of trees, that pretty light bark. So the darker ones got eaten. The lighter ones survived. But then humans changed the environment because of the Industrial Revolution. There was so much coal burning that the soot in the air darkened all the bark of the trees. And so now all of a sudden, most of the individuals were standing out against the background because most of the individuals were light, because that was what was good formerly. And so now natural selection has reversed it, and the ones we see now are dark instead of light. Here we have a tree-like arrangement. All of these lines, notice, have branch points, just like branches of a tree. And in fact, we call this a tree, specifically a phylogenetic tree, which is the modern way in which we group organisms or classify them. It's tree-like because it's based on ancestry, common ancestry. There's a common ancestor that all of these splits involve speciation events, creation of new species by mechanisms of evolution that is really not part of 181 so much as 182. So you'll learn much more about that in a different class. But that's called a phylogenetic tree based on ancestry, not simply on whether things look the same. You know, we used to put things into the same group simply because they looked alike, like a worm and a snake, which would have really nothing to do with each other, very little to do with each other, because they outwardly to us looked the same. Well, that's not how things are done anymore. It's based on ancestry. That brings us to 15, which I'm pretty sure is the last slide of the chapter, which has to do with science and the scientific method specifically, but more generally science. Let's first talk about it as a discipline and compare it to faith, which are two really drastically different ways of looking at the world. Science is belief that's based on evidence, has to be based on evidence. So you can't just choose to believe something if you're acting scientifically. Which is why, as I was saying last time, we can't just say the biosphere is bigger than it is, because we are pretty, the odds are there are living things out there somewhere. That's not evidence. So science is based, this is belief based on evidence. Faith, on the other hand, is belief that's not based on evidence, doesn't have to be based on any evidence, and in fact, it can be belief despite absence to the contrary. Because faith is just something that more or less you're choosing to believe. Doesn't have to be any evidence, and there can be evidence that says the opposite. Well, that's fundamentally different, right? The beliefs that science involves, though, change because they're evidence-based. And evidence changes. So first of all, you're not really, as a scientist, allowed to believe something without evidence. But also, if you've believed something because of evidence for a while, and then suddenly we realize with new evidence that that had been wrong all the time, you as a scientist are required to scrap that belief and start believing the new thing. And that's what we call facts, by the way. Facts, you know, we never really know the truth about anything. But we can be pretty sure of things if we have evidence after evidence after evidence pointing that way. And that's what we call facts. Within scientific disciplines, for instance, there was Newtonian mechanics, named after Newton, which tells us how things move around in the universe. Still being taught, even though we now know it's wrong. It's still being taught because it's a lot easier to learn than what has replaced it, which is quantum mechanics. And because it's still at the macroscopic level, when you're talking about big things, Newtonian mechanics is close enough that you'll get the right answer. But when you consider the microscopic world, Newtonian mechanics breaks down. It's not true, whereas quantum mechanics is, in both macro and micro. So that's a good example of something where we just had to scrap something that we said is true. Now there's a new truth. And getting to the truth involves the scientific method, which I'm sure you've learned at one point in your education, involves steps and whatnot. But at the top here, we have observations. That's really part of just human experience, not really formal science. We notice things about the world. And since we're curious organisms, observations lead to questions. We're curious as to know about knowing why things are the way they are. In this simple example, the observation is that the flashlight doesn't work. So she's saying, I wonder why. Well, questions really beg for answers, right? You want to answer questions. And answers are explanations as to why things are the way they are. Explanations of the observations. And we call those explanations in science hypotheses. Hypotheses and predictions are both listed here. And I want to take a minute to make sure you understand the difference, because I see all the time that people get these mixed up. A hypothesis is an explanation, and linguistically speaking, it is a declarative sentence that says, things are this way because, and then explains why. And it's said in such a way that it's you state it as the truth, even though it might be totally wrong. You're just saying, this is my explanation. And pretending it's correct. And there can be any number of explanations for any given observation, right? Not just two, as you see here, but that's what the hypothesis is. It's an explanation. A prediction, on the other hand, tells you what would happen if that hypothesis were true. So prediction, linguistically speaking, will have like future tense words in it, like will or if. Okay, but they correspond to each other. A hypothesis is an explanation, and a prediction is telling you what would happen if that hypothesis is true. Well, the prediction then naturally tells you how to set up an experiment, which is a test of that prediction. So in this simple example, one hypothesis is that the flashlight doesn't work because it has a dead battery. The corresponding prediction is, if I were then to change the battery, then the flashlight would light. And that tells you exactly how to set the experiment up. Well, just go ahead with changing the battery. Just another, but not the only other one possible explanation, is that the filament on the bulb is bad. So that leads to the prediction that if you replace the bulb, the light will light. Okay, so each test is pretty straightforward. You just do the thing. Now, if the test fails, like it did for the dead battery one, what does that tell us? It tells us that that hypothesis is at least partially wrong, if not entirely wrong. It has to at least be modified, if not scrapped outright. On the other hand, what happens if it comes true like it did for the right one? What does that tell us about the corresponding hypothesis? No, it doesn't. Yes, it tells us that it could be correct, but it doesn't prove it. All we can really do definitively is disprove hypotheses. If predictions come true, we're supporting hypotheses, but we're not proving them, really. For instance, in this case, maybe by unscrewing things and replacing the bulb, you suddenly jostled the battery into the right position so it's making contact. And so you replace a good bulb with another good bulb, and it's lighting now for a totally different reason. And this is exactly why you don't rely on a single experiment in science. And that's why we'd still call that a hypothesis. But in science, you retest over and over, not only as one scientist, but scientists throughout the world keep testing important things over and over. And if the predictions keep coming true, no matter who does it, no matter how many times, eventually we call it a fact. Like quantum mechanics and like evolution by natural selection. Or gravity. Right? That's the difference between hypothesis and things like laws or theories or facts. Okay, that's that chapter.